This is the third cassette in the Joe Herzenberg.
And the last.
interview. The date is July 27, 1995. This is cassette number 7.27.95-JH.3.
Charlotte is a little bit of a puzzle to me. People in Charlotte are always a little defensive about it. They'll say things like, well, people move to the Triangle, as if this were utopia, for the lifestyle or for the political scene here. People move to Charlotte to make money. Well, I'm sure that's true in some cases, but, you know, any generalization, it's weak in other cases. They've got lots of good things going in Charlotte. They have a friend of mine who is a urban planner for the city and county, runs a gay and lesbian film series. You know, we have sporadic stuff like that here.
This friend you just mentioned.
Oh, this guy is a, I can never remember friends' names except when you don't want to. No, his name isn't Robert. His name is, God.
Is it the museum?
No, I don't know where I've never seen him.
Okay.
They've been doing it for, actually he didn't start it. When he moved back to Charlotte, he picked up, somebody else started it. But it's been going on for like 4 or 5 years, I think. And, of course they have more and bigger bars there. Just recently I asked, we have a lesbian on the Pride Pack. A lesbian on the Pride Pack, a black lesbian on the Pride Pack board. And she's on a committee with me for board expansion. And we have these affirmative action, including geographical goals, which are often very difficult fulfill. But I really asked her to try to find another black lesbian in Charlotte. This woman is a lawyer. And she said she didn't know if she knew one. By that she means, I'm sure she knows some black lesbians, but she meant someone who would fit in with the Pride Pack board, someone who's probably professional, you know, middle class, interested in electoral politics. It's a city of, you know, 500,000 people, and there must be another one. But I trust her. She doesn't know one. I believe her. And we've had a hell of a time breaking in to the Triad. We have never really had a board member in Pride Pack from Winston-Salem or Greensboro. And it's basically a Triangle Charlotte group. We've had somebody off and on from Wilmington, and also someone off and on from Asheville, but it's a long way to go for board meetings. So it would be very easy. There was this, I referred earlier to this MA thesis that this woman did with John DeMilio at UNCG. And she started out hoping to do it on the rise of gay and lesbian politics in North Carolina. She ended up doing it on the Triangle. It was just too fragmented elsewhere to make much sense. And I mean, I think she was right. And things are coming along in these other places, but it takes time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Characterize the opposition that most frequently is encountered when these efforts are made.
Oh, you're right. I forgot to explain what they did in Asheville, which was about as stupid, in my view, as a local ordinance could be. They, I think, had the votes in Asheville for ordinance, a non-discrimination ordinance, or, you know, I'm not quite sure the details, amending their housing ordinance, or they may have a general civil rights ordinance. Municipalities have all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. That's a problem often. You know, somebody tries to translate what you do in one town to another. It turned out that Raleigh had years ago been given enabling legislation by the General Assembly. That's another whole problem. For this broad civil rights ordinance, and all they did in Raleigh, all Mary Noe did was amend it to include gay people. And theirs is the strongest ordinance in the state. It goes further than Chapel Hill's, partly because they have more authority to do. They ban discrimination against gay people in all contracts with the city. Well, anyway, in Asheville, they ended up with a public hearing at which like 1,000 people showed up. They had to move it to a civic auditorium. I mean, 1,000 people. And they were mainly, 800 of them were right-wing Christians. And they scared the because I know there were two or three members of the Asheville City Council who came to the march there. And I talked with them, and they were pretty optimistic. This was just a few months later. So what they did was they, to answer your question, people raised these questions like, well, why do gay people need these rights? Wouldn't this mean special rights for them? It's very hard for me to understand that argument, but it's no problem for them to understand it. They seem to think that somehow gay people are getting what other people don't have. And of course, our opinion is just the contrary. So what they persuaded the Asheville City Council to do, basically, was pass an overarching civil rights ordinance with no protective classes. That is, they basically said, there will be no discrimination against anyone in our fair town. And what that means and how you deal with it as a piece of legislation, I don't know. I don't think it even goes so far as to say, for example, in employment, that you can only discriminate on the basis of qualifications that relate directly to the job. I don't think it does that. I think it is so vague, it is utterly meaningless. But when they did it, what could you say? It was the best they could get at the time, and it's hard to criticize the activists for what they did. They worked real hard, and the odds were just against them. I mean, of course, there are specific religious references in parts of both the Old and New Testament that people like to bring up. Somehow they, of course, as a Jew, I don't particularly care what St. Paul is alleged to have said. I don't know if you know the joke about what Jesus said about homosexuality. There's even a book, it's a small book, called, you know, What Jesus Christ, or What Jesus Said About Homosexuality, and you open it up and all the pages are blank, because that's what he said, nothing. But Paul had a way, even though John Boswell thinks Paul is talking about temple prostitute cults. And I hope John is right. I'm sure he's met some of these prostitute cults and met prostitutes in heaven, and they have made it clear to him what it was. But, you know, as a Jew, for these people to harp on a few references in the Torah, and while they leave alone all the other references to, you know, to food and sexual relations and, you know, stoning to death children who don't behave, you know, it's to use a good Old Testament word, an abomination that they just want to pick and choose what they want. I mean, if they're going to go after the references in Leviticus to men not sleeping together, I wish they would also deal with other social problems, like too many pigs in our society, mm-hmm. particularly down east.
You reminded me that I want to ask about if you could characterize the opposition to these, because obviously a lot of it comes out of fundamentalist Christian churches, but there are some other questions to raise about that.
Well, I'll tell you one story. I hate to pick on Rabbi Fisher, but back, what year was that? I don't really remember. A while ago, we were having one of these regional gay and lesbian conferences. They were called Southeastern Gay and Lesbian Conferences in Chapel Hill. We had about 4 of the 10 were here. And it happened that it coincided with the end of Passover. Now, these Now, I'm not a particularly religious person, but I think a lot of gay Christians are really haunted by the rejection from their churches, and that is why the MCC is so great. It's just such an affirming denomination.
MCC is
a Metropolitan Community Church, and I've been to a couple of their services in Raleigh. They're kind of like Salvation Army, in my view. They're really robust, singing great, dynamic, self-affirming hymns and talking about how wonderful we are. I think that's great. And those people need that, and they've been rejected by their churches, and that's very painful for people. But so all of these regional conferences has always had a kind of vaguely Unitarian, non-denominational religious service somewhere, usually on a Sunday morning. But this time, it happened to coincide with Passover, the end of Passover. So I got this notion that we would have a Passover Seder, a gay and lesbian Passover Seder. Passover is a great holiday for gays because it's about liberation. And so I called up and made arrangements, and then they said, no, we couldn't use it.
To use the
Hillel for the Passover Seder.
The campus Hillel.
Yes, so I was really so mad. I mean, it's bad enough to be turned away at the Admiral Benbow Inn because you have black friends with you. But when it's even worse when the Hillel won't let you have a Seder because you're gay, even though you're Jewish. He doesn't know that my mother isn't Jewish. So I really did a nasty thing. I went to the post office and bought 10, they probably only cost about 9 cents then, of postal cards. And I'm not very active in the local Jewish community, so I just picked out a bunch of people who I thought might be active. And I wrote them identical three-sentence postcards. We want to have a gay and lesbian Seder at Hillel. They won't let us. What is to be done? And waited. And, you know, about a week later, I got a call from the head of the local Jewish community saying, when do you want to have the Seder? And to be fair to Rabbi Fisher, who I later learned was really worried that conservative parents of Jewish students here would... they used to let CGA have dances, and once a parent wandered in and saw these men or women dancing with each other and said he wouldn't give any more money to Hillel. That's, of course, what he was worried about. Although he would prefer that gay people come to the general Seder, he would be fine to have a Seder. And he, in fact, came. And he's been much nicer to me since. It was a great Seder. Some other non-gay people, non-gay Jews, came, but the opposition there, as I said, was not really religious or theological. It was the fear that the funding would be threatened somehow.
What year did you say that was?
Well, I don't know. I would guess it's mid '80s. I'm sorry, I can't do better. It's certainly before '87.
Yeah.
But. Of course, nobody in Chapel Hill spoke against domestic partners. In Carrboro, and I do think one reason that the vote was unanimous in Carrboro, even though were a couple of conservatives, in particular Francis Shetley, who is the only person more or less born and bred in Carrboro on their board, and she is the representative of the so-called old Carrboro people. I think one reason she voted for it was she's just been very fond of Mike Nelson for years. They worked with the Democratic Party. She'd been at all those damn conventions. She voted for all those gay rights resolutions. It was just kind of hard to repudiate your own position after you've been supporting it all the years. And familiarity does not always breed contempt. Sometimes it makes it easier for you to deal with issues. Mm-hmm. And in Carrboro, every single person who spoke against, for various religious reasons, I couldn't go to that meeting, I watched it on cable TV, were members of a Calvary Missionary Baptist Church, which is a very conservative church, You know, it's not a typical conservative church. And they brought up all these biblical arguments. And not a single person spoke against it. In all my years on the Chapel Hill Council, eight, but spread over a long period of time, longer period of time, only one anti-gay person ever spoke. And this was, we haven't really talked about this, it's a sort of constitutional issue in North Carolina. This is not a state that has home rule for municipal government. So beyond the ordinary things like having police and fire and garbage collection, you've got to go to Raleigh to ask them for permission to do something. We had to ask them for permission in the early 80s to have a bus system. So every time, I mean, every year or two, you'll see the Chapel Hill Council is asking its legislative delegation for a dozen or so. I mean, some of them are incredibly trivial. Like once we had authority to tow cars that were abandoned on public streets. We had authority to tow cars that were abandoned on private property, but we didn't have authority to tow cars that were abandoned in public parking lots. So I had to get special authority for that. And most citizens, of course, have no understanding of what this is all about. So no pro-gay thing has ever passed the General Assembly. And it occurred to me that one might try to find the minimal proposal. So what I proposed, this was in 91, I believe, was we have all of these official documents, like there's the master plan for the development of Chapel Hill. There's the town charter, the town charter which was granted by the legislature in its most recent form in 1851, I think. And I propose that we put at the start of the town charter a kind of preamble. And it would say, like, in its all of its various functionings and work, the town of Chapel Hill will not discriminate on the basis of all the traditional categories, plus sexual orientation. I guess that's what the term we used. And the council agreed, you know, that's nice, and they understood why I was doing it, and the whole thing worked well. And then some jerk in the legislature said no, you know, so that killed it. So what the legislative delegation did, being a little unsophisticated as far as I'm concerned, was they just took out those two words. And so we're left with this discriminating statement of non-discrimination. So then I got a few people. Lightning Brown came to that council meeting. He was, as he can be, extraordinarily eloquent. He basically said it was wrong to have a statement against discrimination, which in fact discriminated internally. Would the council please ask the legislative delegation to withdraw this? Well, procedurally, this is going to be very difficult because I just got into a fight with one of my colleagues over a non-gay related issue. And this required unanimous consent because it had to be done then. It couldn't be put off another week. It would be too late. And we got unanimous consent. And it was withdrawn. And,
sure.
So what we are stuck with at this point, and I was thinking in connection with what is OLGA, Orange, Lesbian, and Gay Association, going to have on its questionnaire this fall for the Carborough, and it's a little bit of a puzzle to me what we're going to ask them. The furthest we went within the County Democratic Party was asking for an endorsement of gay or same-sex marriage. And I think, you know, there were probably 300 people at that convention. It sounded like two or three people voted against it. But
was that the Democratic County
convention? Probably that was about 3 or 4 years ago already. We're kind of lost for new, you know, we joke around with all kinds of silly things like everybody has to be gay on Thursdays, but which is what this is. We're kind of at our wit's end, except with regard to dealing with the legislature. And where we have gotten, both the Chapel Hill and Carborough bodies voted unanimously this year that they will go, I mean, of course, they can't compel their successors to keep on doing this, but there's at least a moral commitment. They will continue asking the county commissioners to keep going back to the General Assembly forever until this is included. And then we succeeded in getting the county commissioners, who in a surprising move voted 4-1 as opposed to 5-0, to do this, because there is this very good local, you know, what the move to localize civil rights legislation to your law firm was opposed to this initially until we explained to them fully that it would not mean less business. There has been a national move for years to for EEOC and other enforcement agencies to give to local civil rights authorities the authority to deal with discrimination cases. The best case in this state is New Hanover County, which has had it for some years, and they're quite enthusiastic. Even the Chamber of Commerce in Wilmington, which fought it initially, now thinks it's a good idea, that you can resolve disputes at local level without having to go to federal court and hiring expensive lawyers. In any case, Orange County has now done this, and it just went into effect. The whole thing is not into goes into effect next January, but part of it is in effect now, so that if you have a public accommodations complaint, you go to them first. Actually, I think legally you can still go to EU as well, whoever is in charge, whatever federal agency. But in any case, we have this model county ordinance, but they struck out sexual orientation in Raleigh. So that is our focus, is to keep on going back. And that's going to take a long time, I think. I mean, our local delegation says fine. I mean, the Democrats in it. We have a Republican in the local delegation now. But that will take some time. And, of course, it's an odd situation, because ordinarily the legislature will give local delegations whatever they ask for. But this is clearly too threatening or too disgusting or too something for too many legislators. So Pride PAC does always ask, that's in fact the first question for legislative candidates, whether the candidate would support local authority if it was requested to add sexual orientation to policies and ordinances. Mm-hmm. But, of course, it will take, I would guess, the rate we're going with the setback of last year, optimistically 8 or 10 years. So,
let's talk a little bit about the opposition to more progressive ordinances of this sort, to a more progressive set of opportunities for gays in North Carolina. There are different components to it, I imagine. You mentioned earlier there's the sort of white, culturally conservative Republican opposition. There's black church opposition, I guess, at least in some measure.
Yes, although that's the least problematic of...
Well, can you kind of sketch that terrain? Who's out there? And it's not always sincere. Sometimes, I mean, you mentioned with Jesse,
yes,
this is a great political issue, so you're not sure about how sincere folks are when they're...
Well, I'll tell you, I had this friend who worked... Eric Rosenthal, for the Human Rights Campaign Fund for several years. And his standard stump speech, which I heard him give several times, or actually, Barney Frank does this too. Probably he's more well-known and more better at this. And he'll ask this rhetorical question of the, you know, he's speaking as he did in Durham in 1992, I think. He said, he'll ask people, who do you think in the Congress of the United States supports gay rights? The first group, which used to be unanimous, it's a little less than unanimous now, are blacks. Except for those two Republicans, black members of the Congress, they are sophisticated. They understand that, I mean, nobody is arguing that gay civil rights is the same as black civil rights. That would be a moron who would say that. Most gay people are not readily identifiable. Most people who think they're black are readily identifiable. So That's a big difference to start from. But still, there are enough parallels. And one of the most eloquent statements I've ever seen on behalf of gay rights is from Coretta Scott King. So those black members of Congress are supportive. And the same is almost true in North Carolina, partly because the level of sophistication and of contact is somewhat less. And you may have some, I don't know whether she's black or an Indian, Frances Cummings, who I think actually we endorsed, because I think she is such a dingbat that she didn't know what she was saying. Most of, still a very high portion of African Americans in the General Assembly at least give lip service or questionnaire service to gay rights. So that isn't a problem, and I think that the, you know, it was somewhat interesting. I was on one of those Sunday morning, nobody watches them, TV programs back in 86 at the time of the Durham series of incidents to discuss Mayor Gulley's proclamation. And on their side, on our side, there was, it was an interesting group. There was a white woman, not a lesbian, who was the pastor at the MCC church in Raleigh, and me. And the other side, there was one really obscure white Republican and a black minister who at one point put his arm around, was sitting next to me, and put his arm around me and said, "Joe, if you'd only accept Jesus as your personal savior, I'm sure you're be cured of your homosexuality." I said, "Remember, Donald, I'm a Jew and I'm not going to accept Jesus." Anyway, that was kind of odd, having a black person on the other side. I mean, I'd almost never imagined that. You know, and I think even today, when I was in Mississippi, did I ever imagine there would be people like Clarence Thomas? I don't think I did. I think that was not, I was too limited in my thinking to think that's, I mean, I knew there were people who were, you know, not blacks who were not as liberal as I am, or blacks who, you know, had different disagreements on certain things, but Clarence Thomas's? No. Mm-hmm. Or Donald Fozar, who's this Durham minister? No. Mm-hmm. But I don't think so far that is a big problem. It may be a little problem, but the whites are the problem. The white.
Can you tell me about that a little?
Well, not very much, because they're not people I interact with. They're not in my politicals. I mean, I had one conversation with the chair of the Orange County Republican Party, Betty Ibrahim. She was married to, I think he's an Egyptian who was the dean of the School of Social Work. And she's not dumb. She acknowledged that there were gay people in the Republican Party, but she just basically said it. She didn't, and she wasn't proposing to kick them out, but she just didn't think that the Orange County Republican Party was a vehicle for gay rights. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not the Orange County Republican Party, I would guess, is one of the weaker Republican parties in this state, and it's not a very dynamic organization. I lived next door for a couple of years, or he lived next door for a couple of years, former party chair, and we never talked about gay rights that I recall, but he just, the kind of person who would argue that the 14th Amendment wasn't constitutional, was not adopted properly. I mean, if that's where you start, you know, you've got a long way, you've got over a century and a third to go.
Are there other issues that we haven't touched on?
I don't think so. As I'm sure I'll remember, I only wrote about 10 mm-hmm. little things down, and we have talked about, one. Mm-hmm. This was actually not my idea, but after I was elected in 87, It was a very happy occasion for not just me, but for lots of friends and lots of gay people who weren't even friends. But a friend of mine who wrote an article, a long essay in the Daily Tar Heel on their editorial page, and he got me to thinking about things in general, which is not what I usually think about. And one notion that occurred to me that is, and it's something I get from Harvey Milk. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, the Harvey Milk movie.
No.
I think you can get it from the Vizart. Mm-hmm. It's really very good, and it was really well done. And I don't think I would have liked Harvey, from what I've read and heard. He was really kind of obnoxious guy, in many ways, and he was extraordinarily persistent with people who, you know, didn't want to hear his persistent pleas from time to time. I mean, his sort of personality was not one I would like. But I think he had wonderful notions about what politics meant for gay people. And although he didn't put it exactly this way, I tend to see gays as an immigrant group. It's not at all like historic immigrant groups. They're not people who moved from southern Italy or to New York or St. Louis, or they're not even people who moved from southern rural areas to northern cities. There is some geographical mobility involved, but it's more doubly internal, that it's inside geographically and it's inside people's consciousness. And I think that if you went to and listened to the talk at these annual conclaves of gay and lesbian elected officials, what you would hear would be very much like going to, well, I don't know what the organizations are, but maybe the Italian caucus of the New York City Democratic Party at some earlier point. Mm-hmm. I was mayor pro tempore in 1992, and the single most moving thing I experienced, you know, the mayor can't go to all these things, you invite, some of them are little ribbon cuttings, and but I went to a meeting of something called the India America Political Education Committee. It's sort of like the NAACP for people from India and Pakistan. And it does include both Muslims and Hindus and other groups. It's everybody. And they had this meeting in Cary, and the mayors and me of the Triangle Cities spoke at it. And there were several hundred people there. And they claimed there were 8,000 of them in the Triangle. And, you know, from my reading about immigrants, they're a typical immigrant group. You know, they're trying to hold on to their where they came from, and they're trying to become Americans. When the mayor of Raleigh inadvisedly suggested that some of them might want to move back to India, the mayor pro tempore of Raleigh, who was a little more astute, got up and said, realized that was not what these people wanted to hear. She sort of clarified the mayor's remark. That was just a flippant, casual comment. He didn't really want people to move back to India. But it seems to me that gay political people are very similar. It's just that it's more than anything else, because they might not actually move anywhere. Although it is interesting to comment that of all the approximately, there have probably been about 140 now, openly gay and lesbian officials in this country, only one of them serves in a jurisdiction where he grew up. Steve Camara is the vice mayor of Fall River, Massachusetts. Everybody else has moved somewhere, you know, usually from a small town or rural area to a city. Mm-hmm. But I think
that's really quite interesting.
Yes, yeah. Now I told him if I'd stayed in Franklin, my family was so prominent there that I think people would have voted for me even if they weren't enthralled with the idea of voting for someone gay. But I do think that that is what, as Harvey Milk understood, adds such a vitality to gay and lesbian politics, I think. And I do think, for example, this is far removed from North Carolina, that Roberta Ochtenberg may in fact be elected mayor of San Francisco. She is, the other candidates are all able people, but they're all kind of going to be perceived as jaded politicians who've been around, and we want somebody new. And even though there's a black candidate in Willie Brown, I think that Roberta may be able to pull enough black votes, particularly black women, to vote for her. And she's just a very excellent example of this. I think that when she had to stand up to Helms' baiting of her, mm-hmm. she carried on.
Well, Joe, thank you very much.
Thank you.
No, this has been terrific. And if there, we can always do a second session if some other issues float up and we want.
I really had no idea it would take this long. In fact, I really didn't want to take this long because I have a tendency to wander. But
No. It's been really very good. Good.
I do think just one caveat is that particularly with the events of 84, that Lightning may not agree with me. That is, we haven't talked a great deal about this in the more than 10 years since then, but I have the sense whenever it does come up that he had a very different reaction to it. You know, different people react to the same thing different ways. And I just think...
You mentioned he was considerably more bitter.
Yes. Yeah, I think he had a lot more at stake than I do. Our backgrounds are very different. For example, his family was nowhere near as supportive as mine was. So he comes from a Catholic background and not this mixed Jewish Presbyterian background. But I just... you know how what one says is, of course, the truth, but there are other truths.
Sure.
And
before we close, I neglected to ask for a quick character or sort of description of biographical description of Lightning Brown. What he was doing there when he got to Chapel Hill.
He grew up in Southern California, and went after. Going to college at Claremont Men's College and graduate school at the University of Oregon, went to Germany. He was studying German literature. And you know, there's a bizarre thing that despite the awful, beyond any reason, awful experience of the Nazi period, the gay rights movement in Germany never died. There was an article... There's this awful phenomena, too, of people in minority groups comparing their oppressions, which I deplore. But there was a really interesting article in the Harvard Gay and Lesbian Review, which is only a couple years old, but it's done mainly by students. It's edited by students. And analysis of the Holocaust and gay people, and actually gay men, since the Nazis couldn't seem to figure out what lesbians were. But there is no doubt that the Holocaust, as far as gay men were concerned, was a minor phenomenon. It was probably terrifying for them, and probably about 5,000 people were killed in the camps. But if you were sophisticated enough, you could escape them. They had a hard time telling you who gay people were. It's mainly people ratting on each other, according to this article. But in any case, what you find after the war is, first of all, the German government, they may have done it recently, but kept the anti-gay laws on the books. So there's a sort of underground gay movement that is carrying on from the 20s. Well, actually, it goes back to the 1890s through the 30s. And he ran into some of these people in Hamburg. And so was much more sophisticated when he moved here in about how you did gay liberation than anybody else was. He came here in 76. And I think he worked for a long time as a computer programmer for various university programs before he eventually. And he's, he not only was in some of these things, he was far more prominent than I was, and he served very ably on various local government boards. He's really the actual father of the town's greenway system, and served ably on the town's planning board. And then he was even more active, especially in the Democratic Party above the county level than I was on the state executive committee. But then he left all of that to go to law school, which sort of, law school takes up your time, so.
And when did he make that move?
Well, he must have been out of law school now a couple of years, maybe a few more.
You go to law school here at Chapel Hill?
Yes.
Yeah. And he's still in the area?
Mm-hmm, just a few blocks from here.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to mention for the tape that I think it's appropriate that we note that in a number of these organizations we talked about, in fact, all of the following, the Lesbian Gay Democrats of North Carolina, the Gay Democrats of America, or no, excuse me, not that organization, the Triangle Gay and Lesbian Alliance, the North Carolina Pride Pact for Gay and Lesbian Equality, and Orange Lesbian and Gay Association, you were the founder.
Oh, wait, let's see. Well, a founder, I think.
A founder.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's important, I think, to know that you
were
there.
Yeah, I think we should have organizations.
Jeff, thanks again. This has been a pleasure.
I read, you can turn that off, but